It was an absolute delight this week to interview not one but two guests, George and Elizabeth Severn, both students at different times at the University of Kent, mother and son. We learn about George's tactical decision to move to a joint honours programme, to go on a year abroad to Spain. We find out what happened when he returned to his year abroad destination and why he felt like a nosy anthropologist. George talks about having Asperger's and how a logistical problem resulted in time spent in a Spanish institution. He talks about autism, how this has affected him, going to university at the right time, the merits of keeping a diary, and how Elizabeth's diaries inspired George to do philosophy. George talks about why we need to put on a performance in life and will disguise often our day-to-day happenings. They both talk about being drawn to pens and to the importance of handwriting. We talk about the place of social media, who the audience is that one's posts are written for. George talks about how he will edit what he writes on Facebook. He explains why he is the same on social media as he is in real life. We talk about whether it is possible to find profundity in the everyday. We talk about going on a research trip to Cuba, taking photographs of the contents of people's fridges in Cuba, the differences between outdoors culture in Britain and in Spain, obsessing over the small details of a piece of music, why George struggled to understand what was edifying about some of the music he came across on Spotify, and Elizabeth reveals how she came home one day when she was younger to find a member of the band Hawkwind sitting in her house. George talks about why it is important to be open to new ideas. We talk about how this can be applied to elections and to tactical voting. We talk about the utility of literature, the role of religion, whether memories can be predominantly positive in the light of hindsight, why childhood may not have been so wonderful, why George's 15-year-old self would be surprised to find out what he is doing now. And at the end of the interview, we learn whether they are both looking back or forward type of people, and how happiness can allow us to bear the unhappiness that we have to deal with in life. An immense privilege to meet Elizabeth and George Severn for the latest in my nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. It is such a pleasure to have two guests this afternoon. I have George and Elizabeth Severn, not necessarily in that order. So a pleasure to meet you both. And obviously I have only just met you, Elizabeth, but George, I've known you for, I'm guessing it must be getting on for a decade.
Yes, yeah. Because I started here in 2009. Yeah. Yes. And you started, of course.
1983.
Oh my goodness. So yeah. So I'm always telling people, you know, I always get very disappointed when somebody, you know, when present students now were born about 2001 or two, and I think, gosh, that means you would have been at nursery when I came here as a lecturer. But 1983, that does beat me a little bit. So yeah. So gosh. So between the two of you, you sort of amass.
Covered a lot of time.
Yes.
Because you were here a long time,
yeah.
Weren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. And in terms of subject areas, then, so Elizabeth, did you do a degree in philosophy?
Yes, yeah. I did philosophy, and then you had some of the same lecturers as me.
Yes. Yeah. although I, of course, did comparative literature, and then switched midway through to joint honours with Hispanic studies, which was, in a way, more of a headache than it was worth.
But you got to go on an amazing year abroad, I understand.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, yes, because it was partly a tactical decision, because the discipline of comparative literature would have allowed me to do a lot of Hispanic studies. Mm. But the year abroad, they wanted to send me to Denmark or possibly Germany. And I realised that the only way they would send me to Spain is if I went joint honours.
So for you then, the year abroad was the catalyst, really?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, yeah, go on.
It was so great that I went back to do some more. I took a year out, went back to the same place, Toledo, near Madrid. Yeah. Yes, for another year.
And how did you find that? Because it's the same as many students who come here to study, do an undergraduate degree, for example, take a year or so out, and then they come back with a slightly different sort of perspective because they've had that experience of doing something a bit different and sort of seeing something that they had once done through a slightly different lens. Maybe they're a little bit older, a little bit wiser. But what was it like going back to your year abroad destination?
Ooh, well, returning there after a year out of it, it was like returning to a second home, really. Mm. Because for me, I was determined from the outset, the first time I went there, that I was not going to make what I always feel is a mistake and immerse myself with other Brits. Mm. Or necessarily just other students. I was going to go there and go to the places where the locals go, immerse myself in authentic culture, whatever authenticity is. And one of the greatest compliments I got while I was out there was somebody said to me in a bar, "Ah, so you've come here and you're being like a nosy anthropologist." Mm. I thought, well, yes. Yeah. And it was an extraordinary experience because I, of course, was not a typical year abroad student. I went there without a very good grasp of the Spanish language. At one point, I think William asked me, "Can you not write in Spanish?" And I said, "The only time in my degree I think I've actually really written in Spanish has been in exams." Mm. The last time I did any writing in Spanish was in 2006 for my GCSE. Mm. It was because my the language modules. You have to do a certain module in year one, and if you've missed that and joined the party late, you're going to always be in the situation of being a stage higher than you should be. Mm. Yeah.
No, you must have witnessed, experienced all manner of different sort of permutations and the way in which you can best flourish. And it really sounds as though you did. I mean, for me, obviously, I knew you sporadically.
Yes.
During your undergraduate degree, but it really felt that in going to Spain for that year, suddenly it could have gone the opposite way, perhaps. I mean, yes. As anyone's experiences when they're outside their comfort zone for a year.
Yes.
But I remember talking to Elaine and a couple of colleagues who were saying that you sent a postcard and were saying that it was the best time ever.
Oh, goodness. Yes. Well, both the years were the best. They were the best years of my life. Yes. They shouldn't necessarily have been, because I did find it exhausting. Mm. But the second year in particular, when I went and taught English as a foreign language, I've never worked so hard in my life. Mm-hmm. Yes. In fact, I overworked myself, which gave me another fascinating experience. Because having Asperger's, I've always said, I can manage either work, academic work, if you like, or daily living, but I can't do both. Mm. And so I just worked and worked and worked, to the extent where I literally didn't eat every day.
Mm.
And I ended up going into a psychiatric hospital merely because of a logistical problem. Mm. There wasn't anywhere else for me to go.
Yeah.
A maximum security place, because, again, the Spanish don't discriminate. And being bailed out by the university.
Mm.
And even that was a brilliant experience, because you weren't allowed possessions, if you like, as such, but I managed to get hold of a paper and pencil, and I was writing a diary of about 1,000 words a day.
Yeah.
And I was getting to meet all of these strange people who were all just put together in this sterile prison-like environment. Mm. A woman with Alzheimer's, an alcoholic, me, and then your classically mentally ill people. Yes.
Yeah, and you said, had you kept a diary before?
Not to this extent.
Yeah. And is that a diary that you've kept? So do you find it a really interesting? Is it? Diaries can be one of two things. One is simply it's just a record, a concrete record, a factual record of what happened. No. The other is it's a corrective against false memories, distorted memories,
yes.
eulogising of the past. But to have recorded something that is outside a lot of people's daily experience,
yes.
I'm guessing that would have been incredibly useful in terms of, you know, almost trying to make sense of something that would have been way, way, way beyond your comfort zone.
Goodness, of course, because for me the whole university experience was a learning curve, because throughout my entire degree I was suffering from what I realise now was an entirely rational anxiety because of my Asperger's. And attempts were made to correct it as though it was something pathological with medications, etc., etc. But when you realise that the autistic spectrum is not considered an illness simply because the brain is not functioning in a pathological way, merely in a different way, you realise that the anxiety is rational. It is just as rational as putting a neurotypical person into a world run by Aspies. And of course, they'd feel anxious or depressed. Mm. And I recently came off an antidepressant and I realised that it had just been keeping my brain in perpetual fog.
Yeah.
So I had far more difficulty during my degree than I should have done.
Yeah.
And it made me think maybe people do go to university too early.
Yeah. This is always the question, isn't it, about finding the right match between a programme of study and where you are in your life, because it's very easy sometimes to sort of go with the flow, to sort of to leave school at the age of 18, to do what your peers do, to do what the teachers recommend. And there are so many students I've taught who, and it often happens at postgraduate level, but certainly undergraduate level, who just say, well, it wasn't right to do something at the age of 18. And a little bit later, they kind of feel, and maybe sometimes a combination of maturity and life experience, and often just family circumstances, children, employment, that, I mean, often money, it can work the opposite way. And often a student will say, well, I'd love to do my degree in my 30s or 40s, but, in your teens or early 20s, sometimes you don't have those same responsibilities. But I do think increasingly that sometimes if you really have a passion for something, then if it's the right thing for you to do, you will try that much harder to ensure that it fits with your lifestyle, rather than do it because it just seems to be the obvious thing to do, or the only thing to do because there aren't any other choices. That, to me, is the recipe for not enjoying a degree, not getting the most out of it. And, of course, concomitantly, you'll look back in 10 years' time and just say, you know, we have it all the time. Students who sometimes say, you know, I'd like to do a master's. I'd like to come back because I didn't make the most of my first degree, because I wasn't ready for it then. Yes. But boy, am I ready now.
That's exactly how I feel. And I'm very tempted indeed to do a master's for the hell of it. Because I think that, well, for most undergraduates, they will wonder what is going to become of them. For an Asperger person, that worry is that much more intense, because you're trying to fit into a world that doesn't make much sense. And at the same time, you're thinking, well, once I've done this, I'm going to have to work, which is going to be far, far worse than this. And now I've found that all that's going to happen to me is I'm going to be on a funny concoction of disability benefits, which give me a standard of living about slightly better than when I was a student, which I'm happy with. And so I've got nothing to lose.
Yeah, and actually I was really taken by what you were saying about a diary, for example, because then you have your chance to put in your own words your apprehension of where you are situated, how you situate yourself. Diaries are always this corrective, I always think, against madness, if nothing else, because in a world where there is, you know, you have other people's narratives, sometimes other people's inconsistent narratives, or dealing sometimes with somebody who might be in touch, maybe not be in touch, who is keen to cultivate relationships but, you know, falls off the radar, sometimes the diary can be your way of saying, okay, this is my apprehension of what's going on, this is my voice. And you're not then worried about writing in a particular style because you're not doing it for credit, you're not doing it for a degree. I mean, there's academic writing, which does, you know, it's like, I mean, I've got a PhD, it's so obvious that, you know, you play the game, you know, you have to follow certain conventions. If you don't do that, if you don't play the game properly, it's going to hold you back. But a diary, I think, is such a great counterpoint to those kind of experiences. I mean, is that, does that in any way resonate at all, Elizabeth, with your experience?
Well, I kept diaries while I was here, and I think, I don't know where they are now, because you've had them.
So you've read your mother's diaries?
Yes.
Okay.
I think my diaries partly inspired you to do philosophy, because you wanted to have the teachers you'd read me writing about. I used to sit in Keynes, down the bottom as you go in there. I used to sit there every day writing it, just writing my thoughts and writing about things as they happened.
Yes.
And I got quite a lot of A4 diaries. I just wrote reams, drew pictures to go with it.
Mm. And did you sort of organise things according to dates, or was it just stream of consciousness?
I always wrote the date. I did it every day. I did it all the time. I was always writing in there. This has just happened. So it was all fresh. I'd write it immediately.
Yeah, something that I did many years later, because I've kept a diary since, well, I started when I was at school, and then at university, certainly, I haven't stopped. So I think the last time I didn't have a complete entry was at about 1993, so that is 26 years ago. But this is the thing, I was so worried that I would lose all of those hard copy diaries. And it took me many years of, you know, writing at 1 o'clock in the morning, but I would digitise them. And also annotate them. So I sometimes go back and think, I remember far more about that event than what I wrote, because I may have just written a line. But of course, an event can seem far more significant 20 years after it happened. At the time, you just perhaps don't realise the significance of a particular meeting or a talk that you've been to, or meeting somebody, or listening to a bit of music, or something that afterwards you think, that really was an important event. So I was very keen to not distort or change the original reading, you know, the original text, but I would in italics then start to annotate it. And a few years ago, so I started this about 2013, but then I was looking at some of what I'd annotated just about a year ago, and I suddenly realised that some of the annotations, which were my memories, say, 5 years ago, of what had happened 20-odd years before that, were becoming quite blurred. So if I hadn't done what I'd done 5 years ago, I would have been further removed from the events, and I wouldn't have been able to write so much. So I'm glad I did it, but it was one of those sort of, you know, do it now, you're not going to be able to do that again, because inevitably, you know, some memories never fade, but there are plenty of incidental details that just become a bit fused or a bit, you know, you sort of, they take on less urgency. So hold on to them.
That's an idea. I might go back and annotate.
Yes, because that strikes a real chord with me, because I can pinpoint the exact, when I was in Spain for the second time, the exact point that sparked my going into this hospital. I was too eager to open up the chaos of my domestic life. So I let some cleaners into a room that I was living in. If I hadn't let those cleaners in, I could have just lived in a sort of chaos that I have to live in, and everything would have been different.
Yeah.
Because for me, theatre of life, let's see, it's a Teatro de la Vida, it's from about the 17th century. And it's an idea which resonates with me. You have to put on a performance in life, really. And more and more, we don't disclose the unpleasant realities of our lives, of our private lives.
Yeah.
And in Spain, that is very often more true than it is here. People will go home, and nobody except for very close family and very close friends will ever see the inside of a Spanish home.
Yeah.
It's the same in France, I think. People disguise the day-to-day functionings and happenings. Yes, and all you see is what they want you to see.
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you?
What about things like earliest memories? Because we're talking about diaries that were kept at particular periods, but are there particular experiences or episodes or things that kind of made you what you are now, or sort of particular things from childhood, good or bad, but to make you think, yes, it's because of that that I ended up following this path or that path?
Goodness me. I can remember always being very drawn to books, very drawn to pens, very drawn to writing in itself. And you can probably remember that as well.
We both like pens, don't we? We've got a house full of pens.
Do you do what I do, though, and chew them to bits?
No.
No, good. Then naturally, then you have far more respect for your for what you do than I do. I always know if I'm marking essays or exam scripts, because I end up on the floor with a particularly, well, let's put it this way, lots of plastic, which tops and you know, big biros and so on that have been chewed to pieces. And it obviously says something about my sort of state of mind and the focus. I'm always sort of doodling on the page. But so pens, how interesting. Is it sort of like biros or fountain pens or a whole range of different types of
all
writing?
Sorts of pens. I like them all, even the free ones you get through the post, anything. I like them all.
Yes, for me, I think my liking of pens, the range goes even further, because you limit yourselves to biros.
No, don't you? Any pens.
Whereas I enjoy biros, but also reusable fountain pens, ball pens.
Those as well, yeah.
Which you don't use.
I do use. I don't let you see them.
But is this for collection or for writing?
No, for writing.
It is. So you actually do use them, yeah.
Well, sometimes I think that's too good to use.
That was what I was going to ask. Because sometimes, you know, and also because there may be a very ornate pen, beautiful, you know, but which, if it's a matter of like writing out a card that you're going to put in the post, you know that as soon as it starts raining, either before you hit the letterbox or when it's in transit somewhere, it's all going to fade. So you sometimes know that you just have to sort of think, who is this made for? Is it meant to be kept for eternity? You know, if it's a card that you think somebody might want to keep, well, you want to make sure at least that it's written in. But I always used to use biros, and generally a lot of that hasn't faded. But I've even, you know, outside my office door, I put up a note saying, you know, these are my office hours, and then, you know, but as soon as I've written it, it's like I can't read it, it's faded. So sort of things you take for granted, but of course it depends. It says something about the way that you keep, that you maintain, you want to archive sources that you're writing.
I think that we're both very keen on keeping writing in its handwritten form. For me, it's partly because I approach technology warily, because what you have with technology is something very fast-paced, something extremely distracting. You can take out a smartphone, and I can take out my smartphone or go onto my computer and intend to write a blog post, and then find that I get distracted by YouTube, by my phone, binging and pinging, and emails, and goodness knows what else, and find that I've wasted hours.
But there's one thing I've really noticed, George, is that you really do use Facebook, you use it very well, and you really seem to enjoy doing, I think, what the medium is good at, which is having not lots and lots of words. I sometimes write very long film reviews. I know nobody is necessarily going to read them. I'll save plenty of time for that. But it's always very interesting, isn't it, how sometimes you know that people realistically are just going to be scanning. But it's making sure that if you want to get a photograph out there, if you want to just sort of sum up in just a few words a particular mood, then for me, obviously the diary, no one reads my diaries except me, but it's interesting that on Facebook I kind of feel that it's almost like a little window into what I do, but it's a very small window. I mean, obviously, whereas a diary will have this whole sort of, you know, this is when the day started, this is when it ended, and you might have 2,000 words. On something like Facebook, you're often saying, I went to the cinema and this is what I saw. And of course, if you just look at the post in isolation, you think, oh, all he ever does is go to the cinema, because that's all his post. But in reality, the other 22 hours a day may not be recorded in that way.
Yes.
So it's like a window, but I sometimes feel anyway that I want to make it as representative of what I do as possible, but without then breaching not just privacy or other people's privacy, but also just sort of doing things in the right sort of balance, that it's written for an audience, and you know, an audience in a hurry, an audience who have to, you know, if they're going to stop and read your post, there may be 100 other friends or 1,000 other friends they might have who may also be competing for your attention, but you seem to get it right.
Thank you. Well, when I write posts on social media, I'm aware that I'm writing for an audience, and one of the things that I've always liked is, in terms of writing, I found when I was studying literature that my interest with how the words are put together and how they flow, the punctuation used, can, to an extent, impede the meaning for me. I will be focusing on the wrong thing. I'm interested in how it's put together and how that works. And so I'm acutely aware as I'm writing that that I need to say something in the right way, because it is then going to be published. And so I will edit what I've put, which I think is something that people don't do very much. They will just write something, misspell things, who cares?
Yes, no, I'm the same as you in that sense. I'm very aware that there is an audience.
Yes.
And a hidden audience, in the sense that sometimes somebody may not ignore. I've met old university friends. There was a funny moment. I was at Waterloo Station about a year ago, waiting to meet somebody, and suddenly a voice appeared. It said something like, you know, Christopher Decius, I live and breathe. I sort of turned around, and immediately I knew who it was, but I hadn't seen them in 25 years, an old university friend. And she said, so how are you? What are you doing these days? And I started speaking, and I thought, okay, where do I begin? She said, well, actually, I do know, because, of course, I've been following your posts on Facebook. And she knew exactly where I'd just been, probably knew where I was about to go. But, of course, in terms of polite conversation, sometimes it's, you know, even with people that you converse with all the time on social media, when you meet them in person, you often wear a different hat. Because sometimes I've noticed that people don't always talk about or acknowledge their social media life, because they might be very angry on social media. They might be talking about Brexit or something that is really getting them worked up. But when you meet them, they'd be terribly calm, or it's almost as though they will tell you on social media all the things that sort of, because it's on social media, they don't need to bring it up in any other context. So you see a different side to somebody through what they put out, but it's not necessarily representative of everything else. So when you meet them in the flesh, you think, oh, you're not how I imagined. is that your take as well?
No. I am consciously completely the same on social media as I am in real life. Because if I give my opinions on things, I don't see why I shouldn't give my opinions, even if people don't like them, as long as they are not offensive, as in hate speech, we are becoming too sensitive to opinions as merely projections of what somebody thinks. And we're seeing it more and more. People are acting as though the Almighty himself has pronounced judgment on their new dress or something. Yeah. If you don't like it, and if you dare say, well, it's not to my taste, but
absolutely. Have you succumbed to the evils of social media, Elizabeth?
Yes, George got me onto Facebook, and I do like it, keeping in contact. But when I was here, I'm really thankful that we didn't have internet when I was here. I think if we'd had it, I'd have been on it for far too long. Yes. Perhaps wouldn't have worked as hard as I did.
Yeah, yeah, because it can. There are some people who will use social media in order to advertise what they're doing. Mm. So a lot of PhD students will often talk about conferences they're interested in or are given papers at. That's actually, so it's a very much an extension of what they do. Whereas for other people, as you say, it's the opposite. And it's all about the sort of, you know, what they watched on television or something, which, you know, to different degrees. Or, of course, they just, the thing that actually I hate about when somebody will just repost something else, or they come across an article and it might be something they randomly came across, and I think, well, you've just, I mean, if somebody actually says this is why you should read this piece, then I might read it and think, oh, okay, you've given me an incentive. But if I just see random pieces from, you know, which they, you know, it's not necessarily a, you know, an official news site, but it might just be something from a magazine or something that might just be, as you say, there might be hate speech or something, then in that sense, why would I click on that? It's sort of, no one's giving me the incentive to open it, which is why I like to post original items, inverted commas. So rather than just say, you know, I've been to see this film, I'll say this is why I've gone to see this film. So then it's sort of personalising and putting a signature. So, and I think that that's when Facebook can be reused well. It's when people will just sort of repost, in some cases, racist or sexist or misogynistic items. Then that's when all sorts of problems unfold.
And people use Facebook for, sometimes I think, quite vapid purposes. The number of times you see people who have put up pictures of themselves, which have been so... I don't really keep up with what it is. Instagram filters, I think. I don't understand what they're doing. But it's just becoming a contest in how does your food look? How do you look? An aesthetics competition.
No, and I tried this out once because I was conscious that I was putting up sort of what I would call more perhaps scholarly based posts or erudite posts, as I'd like to see them. And I might get, like, if I'm lucky, one or two likes and, you know, maybe a comment if I'm lucky, but often nothing of the kind. And I tried it out once. I was over in the Rutherford Dining Hall. It was last Christmas. And I was butter tucking to this lovely plate of roast turkey. And I thought, oh, you know, let me just put this up on Facebook just to see what happens. You know what happened? I got more likes for the plate of food in front of me. And I was doing it sort of in an ironic way.
Yes.
But afterwards I thought, yes, but then I thought, but in a way, if I really want to make a mark, or if I want people to be aware of what I'm doing, I have to post inane posts like this, sometimes in order for someone to actually at least then sort of think, oh, you know, what else is he up to? Mm. But sometimes I sort of feel I'm compromising myself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, we should have taken a photo of that Chinese meal we had in Toledo.
Oh, goodness. Yes.
It was I need
to hear this story.
The worst meal we've ever had, wasn't it?
Oh,
we can't even remember now what it was exactly.
Yeah.
But that was something that we could have photographed.
Yeah.
And I did find myself thinking, well, hang on, is this Chinese food which has just been appropriated to Spanish tastes as opposed to English tastes?
Yeah.
I think that you can often find profundity in the day-to-day.
Yeah.
And that's something which I... the first time I started realising, I find day-to-day situations profoundly interesting, as well as rather more highbrow areas. I thought, well, hang on, this seems rather wrong. Mm. But then I realised, no. You can find some extremely important things in people's day-to-day lives. When I went on a research trip to Cuba, oh goodness, one day everybody else, they went off, I think they went off on a boat trip. I don't know where it was, to do something very typical of a scholarly research trip. I don't know, go to see somebody and hear them lecture. I went and met two Cuban people and paid them to go and rummage around in their fridge and take photos of their house and buy their old ration book.
It's interesting, yes, what you say actually about the everyday, because this is always the thing about holidays, isn't it? That you want something really special, and therefore you do more photographs, more posts, more postcards, more as you discovered when you were in, in Spain, you were recording in a diary. But for me, and I did it the same when I was at school, sometimes, you know, when you're actually at school, the day-to-day things sometimes you don't tend to record. But when it's like the half-term holiday, or the summer holiday, the first day of the holiday, I'll start writing all these posts. But often, of course, then it's like, oh, I watched the TV today because I've been in school for the last 3 months. Therefore, I'm going to, you know, so the diary is full of something that doesn't feel, this is what I'm getting at, doesn't feel representative of what you were doing. So the danger is that, and the same what I said about posting up film reviews and so on, you know, that's one part of what I do, but it's not all that I do. But otherwise, you could end up with a succession of summer holiday snaps. But sometimes in the future, you look back and say, that's all well and good, and that was a great summer. But what was I doing when I wasn't on holiday? Yes. What is the day-to-day stuff? Yes. Because sometimes holidays can be very disappointing because of the expectations. But the things that allow us to get through day-to-day, the so-called mundane, can sometimes be exactly where, you know, in, or to put another way, what makes you get up in the morning? What gives you that sort of incentive? Yes. And that, I think, is something that has more power attached to it than something which is perhaps a bit of a contrived episode, and which may take you so far outside of your comfort zone that to have a record of that doesn't necessarily paint a very complete picture of what it is that was being, or you're attempting to encapsulate through, for example, a written record.
Yes, yes, it's those sort of mundane activities which give us the really underlying fabric of what a society is about, because I found that when trying to learn about foreign cultures or past cultures, some of the most accessible materials that I can get my hands on are books which deal with the mundane, how Victorian people actually lived in their day-to-day lives. And through this sort of material, you then find you are building up a very strong, well, a critical framework, really. And so when you read somebody like Hardy or Dickens or whoever, you can recognise what they are coming from. Yes.
That's what's been interesting in our relationships with Spanish people.
Yes.
We've made lots of friends in Spain, haven't
yes.
we?
Yes.
And it's listening to, and just how they differ in everyday life. I asked Mammon what made her most surprised about English people. And it was, she said it made her laugh and laugh to see us English people going out on an excursion, on a family excursion, and sitting down, perhaps in a park or on the beach, having a picnic with the family. And I said, what do you do then? And she said, well, of course, we go and sit down next to anybody else who's out. You sit right next to them with them, and then more people come until you're a big group.
Yes.
You don't sit in little groups that you've come with. You all get together. And it struck me as being like a swarm of bees all sticking together, getting together, whereas we stay separate.
Yes, I was very aware of that. When
Mammon, we should probably mention, was the psychologist who was my contact while I was out there. Extremely eccentric woman. Yes, she didn't conform to stereotypes at all. Psychologist and opera singer.
Oh, wow. Well, that does paint a picture, yeah. But you're right, though, Elizabeth, because I found this when I've been in Europe, where there's very much an outdoors cafe culture, and everyone sits outside, and it's very much, it sort of feels that people are very keen to be around other people. Sometimes in Britain, I sort of feel that, you know, if I'm in a restaurant, I'll sort of find, oh, there's a seat in the corner that nobody's at, and I'm far away from everybody else. And that sense sometimes that you don't want to tread on anybody else's toes, you don't want to disturb someone, you don't want to be a nuisance, or sometimes you just want your privacy, you just want to perhaps go to a restaurant, read a book. Of course you can do that if you're in the Czech Republic, or you're in Spain, or whatever. But it does feel that there's a different kind of mentality, and it feels very open and beautiful in a way that, you know, here, normally having tables, you know, of a cafe outside on the street doesn't seem as romantic somehow as it does if you're on the Algarve, for example. So you're right, that sometimes we need to have those other experiences. But am I right in thinking then, Elizabeth, so were you in Spain as well for some of that period?
Well, I went out quite a few times to see George there. Yeah. But I was doing a degree in French and Spanish at that time. I was doing a degree with the Open University. Oh. Because that was what I originally wanted to do, languages. And so I was going out there to brush up on my Spanish as well.
Yeah, so well, worked out very well for both of you. But what about, so you mentioned books, music. Did that, has that ever played a big role in your lives in different formats, whether going to live music or listening to music at home or in the car or wherever, you know, as you're going about, does that in any way, or has it ever impacted on you?
Yes. Again, for me, well, music, I obsess over the small details. I will enjoy listening to two different arrangements of a song or composition of some kind and seeing how they differ, or rather hearing how they differ. I find that I'm receptive to the key in which something is played, the instruments that are used, and I think most curiously for me was, well, you told me, it surprised me, you said that most people actually naturally gravitate towards music from their own era.
Yeah.
And I can remember sitting down when in about 2010 and thinking, right, so this modern music that people listen to, this pop music, I'm going to go on Spotify and work out, I'm going to critically work out what it is they like about it. I tried and tried, and well, I think it flummoxed me in the way that trying to critically analyse the Bible flummoxed me. I couldn't make any sense of it. I couldn't find anything in these pop songs that I considered very...
But because I think we're all evangelists in the sense that sometimes if there's something that really speaks to you, if you hear a song and maybe you associate it with a particular period of your life or a particular event, because it's so momentous to you, you sort of assume or want to assume that somebody else will also hear it and say, gosh, this, you know, if it's made this sort of impact on you, and if other people are on your sort of same wavelength, then you hope and expect that in some way they'll see where you're coming from. But I think you are right that sometimes I just don't understand. I've been on buses sometimes and somebody will put something on very loud and I just think this is horrible, or, you know, for all I know it sounds, often it's hate speech or something, you know, I think, you know, this is you won't get this on Radio 2 or Radio 3 but I find that interesting though, that sometimes the music that we grow up with is very much the music that carries through into adulthood. I'm aware that whereas somebody might say to me sometimes, oh, but you've seen that film before, why would you want to watch it again, you know what happens, Nobody says that about a piece of music. Nobody says, if you're a fan of, I don't know, of Elvis Presley, no one will say, but you've heard Blue Suede Shoes before. When you listen to it again, you heard it in 1957 or whatever it might be. So, and of course, we'd say that's absurd. Because we sometimes need to have that as a go-to, almost perhaps as a reminder of who we are. Because they say, this is very precious, this is me. But then, as I say, when you either can or cannot share that with somebody else, then you know that can be the recipe for all sorts of turmoil and disagreements. But was that your experience as well, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I found it very useful when I was learning Spanish, listening to Spanish music. Yeah. We both did, didn't we? And learning all the words of songs. And I just found that very useful, and it became my favourite music after a while.
And you still listen to it now?
I still do now, okay. Yes.
So you brought Spain into your present?
But there are certain songs that I think you associate with certain things, and you therefore... Now, what is that song? I wish I could remember what it's called. You met some peculiar band who had a number one with... it sounded like... They had
Silver Machine.
Yes, and it's a bit of a dirge, but you love it because you met this band. Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah. Where did you meet them?
Oh, dear, well, it started off with my mother, who was very religious. She brought one of them home. She was always evangelising on the streets.
Oh.
And the leader of the band, I came home, I was about 17, and there he was, sitting in my house.
Did you know who he was?
Yes, I did. I was quite appalled that she should know him. And then he had a big problem with drugs, and she used to go and visit him in hospital. So she got quite friendly with him, much more than I ever did. I tried to keep away when she had him round. But then separately, I met the band when I was out one night, and we all went back to their house because they lived nearby in Westgate. And that was it, really. I didn't know them well, not the way my mother did.
that sounds one of the craziest sort of stories, because it sounds as though you knew who they were, but your mother might not have done.
Mm.
She didn't invite. She effectively invited a celebrity back to her house without even knowing he was a celebrity.
Yeah.
And you walk. This is like a film script. And you walk home one day, and you think, there's a celebrity in the home, but it almost like by accident.
Yeah.
So how did all that play out? did the contacts remain, or did it all sort of fade away in later years?
I suppose later. I think I don't know what happened to him really, but it fizzled out.
Because she was, I suppose, determined enough to not be starstruck. Yeah. She had met him for a purpose that was important to her.
She
not knowing or caring.
The music, she really disliked it. Mm. That old rubbish.
Yeah.
So did she know who he was?
She knew that he was this person who did things she didn't think much of. That was all.
Yeah.
That's what she thought of my philosophy. She thought of that old stuff.
Often these things can be a real spur, though, can't they? Because sometimes you find that you want people to be supportive of what you do. You like people to sanction what you're doing. But sometimes you also think, well, if somebody gives you a reason not to like something, and you see it with the Brexit debate and all sorts of things, that sometimes, you know, rather than change your view on something, you sometimes feel, okay, well, that's made me even more keen to hold, you know, to stand my ground. And I think that the way in which our individuality sometimes comes out can be through all these kind of juxtapositions, all these dialectics.
Yes. Although I do think that it is very important to be open to new ideas, and people do hold on to their ideas because their ideas give them comfort for far too long, for emotional reasons rather than logical reasons sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so because what do you... I mean, are you willing to change your mind?
Yeah.
That's always one of the questions I ask in these interviews relates to politics. And sometimes my sense when I was when I first voted, which would have been in the 1992 election, I was with a lot of student friends of mine who were very much sort of voting in the way, if they voted at all, it was as their parents voted. It was a kind of family thing handed down to the generations. I'm not sure that that happens now to anything like the same degree. And so I've noticed that shift, almost the sense, which is why I think, you know, you sometimes see candidates winning seats in places that, you know, you would never have given them a chance 30 years ago. And I think that sometimes politics is a very interesting barometer of the capacity sometimes for, and we see it with tactical voting, certainly, and we no doubt will see it at the next election, where, you know, if there's a chance of a in a Leave seat or a Remain seat, you know, candidates who sort of will sort of try to ensure that they get, and if it means they don't vote for their preferred candidate, they vote for a candidate who will stop the enemy from being elected. but is that something that the sort of you've noticed over the years, the sort of the way that people can change their mindsets and sort of think outside of the box in a way that would have been unthinkable decades ago?
Oh, I've certainly changed all my life. Every election has been open to me. I could have voted for anyone. Never had a political party that I stuck with.
Well, no. And whereas I find that I, I, of course, will assess the situation and vote for whoever I think will do the best job.
Yeah.
Of course, to an extent, I think that tactical voting can be necessary. I suppose an example here, we've got an excellent Labour MP who seems moderate. But if you vote her in, there's the risk of Jeremy Corbyn getting in. And I'm not convinced that communism or Marxism or whatever it is he wants to bring about would be the best thing for the country. Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's, do I vote for her and risk getting Corbyn in, or vote for somebody else? And
and it's similar to the census every 10 years when you, again, sometimes have to tick one box, but you wish you could vote for more than one. Of course, PR can give you the chance to vote for more than one candidate, and that can be very freeing sometimes because you have the chance to almost sort of say, well, you know, this, you know, life isn't about single box ticking. Sometimes we all wear multiple hats. And as you rightly say, there was a candidate, it was the Vale of Glamorgan, which was a neighbouring constituency to where I used to live when I grew up in Cardiff. And it was one of the most marginal seats which the Conservatives had held. And they had a very popular local candidate who apparently would always like write to anybody in his constituency who had a birthday, send them a birthday card. So he was a very popular MP, but not a very controversial one. He wasn't a minister. This was back in the 80s, and he died. And Labour won the seat in the by-election with the slenderest of majorities. The name was John Smith, actually, as I remember. Not the same John Smith who led the Labour Party, but the South Wales MP, John Smith. And then, in 92, the Conservatives won with, and I think it was the most marginal seat in the country, with a majority of something like 19. And the MP then was very Eurosceptic, and he was one of the Maastricht rebels and so on. But it was just really funny to sort of see how, you know, all sorts of factors come into play to elect a candidate, the personal factors, the ideological factors. But you went from very sort of moderate Conservative MP to a very very well-respected Labour MP to a more extreme Conservative MP who then lost his seat in 97, and then I think I'm right in saying the same Labour MP won the seat back again. So one of those sort of seats where all of these, you know, fascinating changes that the MPs were, even from the same party, came from very different wings of that same party.
Yes.
And I find that on so many levels. If I had more time in my life, you know, I would love to study that sort of, you know, the motivations, the factors that lead to somebody, you know, electing a particular candidate at a particular time, and then whether that candidate disappoints them in the ensuing 5 years.
Yes. And I think that one of the things which must be a reward for people who study that sort of topic and go into that as a career is that it provides something very, very real almost tangible. A tangible career. What you are doing has a demonstrable impact on the world. Mm. Whereas with literature, sometimes after years of studying it, after years of reading, you start to realise, I certainly realised towards the end of my degree, what is the point? I'm sitting here, I'm just writing essays that one person will read. Mm. What am I doing? Mm-hmm. Yes. Which, again, led me, that was partly what led me into Hispanic studies, thinking this will be a bit more practical, yeah, almost. Yeah. Yes. Because literature alone, it can get disheartening.
Mm. That's how I felt with philosophy when I was doing my PhD for years and years, and then I had you, and it suddenly seemed quite irrelevant to be thinking about what is time and what could there be backward time, or could you, all these different things, and I had nappies to change.
Yeah,
That's when I. Yeah. Gave it up for a while.
Yes, but then again, you see, what I mean is slightly different. I mean about doing something for good in the world, almost. Nappies to change are just boring irrelevance.
But then literature.
Just guess your way through that.
Literature's good, isn't it?
Well, yes, but again, what are you actually doing with it? What are you doing?
Well, it's having ideas and sharing them, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You need that as well as all the other things in life. You need to reflect on things.
Well,
literature,
yes.
Literature enables you to do that.
Well, what about religion? Because you mentioned about your mother being quite evangelical. Oh. Is that something that has... But doing a philosophy degree as well, I can imagine that may not have necessarily been... This, you know, you weren't looking at the same sort of questions in philosophy that you know, I always think that there are some wonderful students, many of my students do joint honours philosophy, religious studies, but I can imagine that if you come from a very particular faith background, philosophy is not an obvious fit in terms of the sort of the way that questions are posed. And
I remember having
one academic in Lampeter where I did my degree who was very keen to say there's no room for God in this department, and I thought, gosh, that's, you know, we need to unpack that. But so was that a source of tension?
Oh, definitely. Growing up, I had some terrible rows, but I suppose I would say I am religious, and it's very important to me, but not in a way my mother would have recognised. I think she would say that I wasn't.
Mm. Yes.
And you're probably the same, but...
Well, I'm the same, and perhaps even more vague than you.
I pray...
Yes.
...every day, but perhaps not in a way my mother would think of as praying. It's...
Yes. Whereas I... Well, I've always been vaguely Christian. And I actually, when I started here, tried to be a bit more active as an Anglican. And it was quite funny because, of course, Stephen Laird approaches religion from a point of scrutiny, which I really liked. Well, he considered baptising me and confirming me, or something. And I said, well, what are you going to ask me, these declarations of faith? And he came out with terrible questions. I can't remember what they were, but each one of them would require an essay to answer. They were appalling questions. Mm. And in the end, we called it off. I think neither of us would have been able to get through it without laughing.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the way, isn't it, when sometimes somebody has a very fixed understanding of what something might be.
Yes.
And then somebody else might, as you say, not be unreligious, should we say, but from the other person's point of view, it's not quite what they understand by that term. And there's all sorts of, probably why... why I studied this professionally. Because for me, you know, this whole notion that when somebody tells you what religion is, it always says more about them than it's about religion.
Yeah,
you know, you know what their take of religion is, but the idea that that is religion, it's, we want a first of course called What is Religion? And it's all about that very kind of, you know, fascinating series of trajectories that we're all talking, using the same language, but what actually we mean by that will vary from person to person.
Also, my mother was, she was very much, the Bible was literally true, every word. Every word was so important. And studying other languages, I see how ridiculous that was, because I've got a Bible at home that's in Spanish and English, and I can see the differences in those two texts, that they're not saying the same thing quite often. And to think that neither of them is the original language in which it was written. So how can my mother be pinning things onto these few words? We don't have the original.
Oh, yes, it goes into Wittgenstein's ideas, doesn't it, that we can't talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of philosophy, I was just going to round off with a few more philosophically based questions. And what you were saying about time, actually, I think we'll probably come up in just a second. But would you say, either of you or both of you, that your memories are predominantly positive?
Ooh. Memories of being here?
Of your whole life.
Ooh. Goodness, that is difficult. And probably not because of hindsight, maybe. Yes. And maybe it's impossible to have predominantly positive memories, because in order to do that, you would have to... You'd have to be quite shallow. You would have to not reflect, not question what you did.
Because I always think that there's a related question there about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. And it comes back to what we were saying about keeping a diary, or almost a corrective against reimagining the past or distorting the past in the light of current experiences. But is there that sense, not least in nostalgia, whereby we are looking at the past through a particularly rose-coloured lens?
Ooh.
I don't look back on the past with nostalgia at all. I didn't enjoy being a child. I had a lot of unhappiness as a child. And I knew then, I always thought, things will never be as bad again. Once I'm grown up, things will be better. As my mother used to say, well, childhood's the happiest time of your life. And I knew that she was wrong. I just knew I couldn't have gone on if I'd thought this is the best time of my life.
No, I think you're right on that, because, and maybe this is another reason why writing a diary can be quite efficacious, because you then have a concrete record from a particular time and place that will indicate your state of mind. And so you can indeed look back and, you know, I mean, so it works both ways. Sometimes you think, oh, I really enjoyed that particular year, or that, or I went to see a certain film and I really liked it. Look at the diary and say, no, I was writing something very different at the time. I may be reviewing that event with hindsight, but at the time, you know, I might not have been, you know, thinking in a particularly positive way about something, and vice versa. But sometimes there is a match, and there might be particular events, and often involving other people. It might be birthday parties, and, you know, there's maybe a particular year when, and it happened in my case, I think when I was 20, when I had almost all of my friends, it was during the university term time, all able to assemble together. So there was just that moment where all my friends were together in one place, and I was there, and it was an evening that sort of everything sort of went the way it should have done. It was just everybody sort of, you know, was relaxed a little bit, but we were all kind of, the evening went well, and, you know, nobody left early. There were plenty of fun games, like running little quizzes and, you know, bits of music for everyone to listen to. And I think that, you know, for me, everything sort of came together in the right way. But the diary corroborates that. So when that happens, you say, I know that was a good memory. The diary says it was. So I'm not, you know, looking at that through a different lens, for example, because those friends are no longer around, in the sense that I may have lost touch with them, you know, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those sort of correctives.
Yes, whereas I can remember not finding a childhood particularly liberating, because I've always had quite a mature mind.
You never wanted to be a child, did you?
No.
When you went to school, you had to say that you were one of the teachers. You couldn't bear to be a child.
Being a child, there didn't seem to be any freedom. You were stuck talking about inane things sometimes. Mm. At secondary school, it was worse. But looking back, especially at my secondary school years now, I realised that, well, in a way, that was when I was able to be at my best in terms of producing high-quality essays, doing well academically, because I didn't have to worry about the other side of life, the side of life that you just took care of. Cleaning, cooking, washing, ironing, etc., etc. And now I have to try and volunteer, write, blog, and simultaneously just guess my way through laundry cycles and how to wash up.
But would either of you say that you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, if you had dreams? Or to put another way, what would say your 15-year-old self think about what you're doing now?
My 15-year-old self would be shocked. Because, well, for me, it's fairly straightforward. Because in my world, I had you keeping control, Ma. Of things. Nobody was expecting me to suddenly have difficulties because no one had seen them coming. No one had seen that I was going to have difficulties with maintaining daily life and scurrying around haphazardly, trying to iron a shirt and and read a book. I remember once I failed to attend an exam. I got in the shower one morning, thinking about a question that had been on the last on the last year's exam. I came out having answered the question in my head
in the shower.
Yes, I had. I'd gone through the entire thing. Yes.
And did you then? Was there a point at which you then realised that you hadn't actually sat the exam that you were meant to do? I mean, how did that all pan out? Was there another opportunity for you to sit the exam?
Oh, of course, resits and whatever, yes.
But what about friends from the past? I mean, are you in touch with anybody? I mean, social media obviously gives you that option, but are you in touch with many people from your childhood, for example, or university?
I've made friends again with my best friend at school through Facebook. That was good. I've kept up with friends from university. They're my best friends, really.
Sometimes those conversations can just carry on, can't they? Sometimes you might think, gosh, whatever did we have in common? I don't recognise it at all. But that's not my experience. My experience, on the whole, is that suddenly it's sort of, we're immediately in that same world and the same things are being referenced, the same people in some cases.
Yeah.
I had it just the other day, somebody I hadn't seen in 25 years, and immediately we were, you know, I was thinking, I know that name. Yes, I now remember you used to go around with that person. That person wasn't somebody I necessarily knew. But suddenly, immediately, it sort of took me back to a time and place which was central to that person's sort of way of looking at the world. Same for me.
Yes.
We may not have had exactly the same friends, but there was enough of a sort of community there that was just being conjured up by the conversation. And we had all this in common, a shared past.
Yes, and for me, I suppose I feel in a similar way to you. I made friends with people because I got on with them because of sharing certain core values, ways of looking at the world, or because they interested me as people, and they're unlikely to stop doing that.
Absolutely, And my very last question for both of you, would you consider yourselves to be looking back or looking forward type of people?
I think I'm always looking back and making different sense of things.
Yes.
Things that didn't make sense at the time, and now I see. As I've changed my idea, when I was here and studying moral philosophy, the idea was happiness is your goal in life, that's the greatest good, it's all about greatest happiness, that sort of thing. And I've come to change my mind on that. I think happiness is what keeps you going, so that you can bear a lot more unhappiness, because it's really the grueling things in your life, the tough times, that make you develop as a person. So I've changed my view, and I'm constantly looking back and reevaluating, I think.
Yes, I do find that I spend a lot of time inside my own head, introspectively, and looking back, looking at myself, trying to analyse myself and the world around me more and more. But at the same time, I do look forward, thinking, what shall I do next? What can I read next? What can I look at next? Mm. What can I do next to develop myself?
Yeah.
Yes.
I have learnt so much. I think just it's wonderful to have two generations clearly enjoying each other's company, bouncing ideas off each other, and have a very sort of shared experiences, sort of doing the same sort of thing, maybe at different times, maybe in the 1980s, back in the 2010s. But what a wonderful, what a privilege to have met you both. So thank you, Elizabeth and George. Thank you.
Thank you.